This is the business of Africa. If it's about Africa, then it's our business, bringing big and small business issues right to your doorstep. It is said that curiosity keeps leading us down new paths. With all that is happening in the world, I often wonder what keeps nations thriving. Some more than others, where citizens of less thriving nations at times risk their own lives to attain the proverbial milk and honey. Afro-optimists will berate me for wondering about the seeming lack of economic progress on the African continent. Hear me out. From the little I've seen from countries visited, there's a pattern I've witnessed that has made me rather uncomfortable. Young people are locked out of the economy. There's a lack of decent housing and sanitation, a lack of access to healthcare, more so mental. I could go on, but let me park here, because the question then becomes whether the continent's economic systems are generated towards an Africa risen. Yes, progress has been made, but is it at the pace consistent with the population growth when it is said that we are the youngest continent? Simon Brown is founder of Just One Lap. He joins us now to look at the concept of an economy and the role it plays in lifting people out or locking them in poverty. Mr. Brown, sir, thank you very much for your time on the Business of Africa podcast. Maybe let's start with a basic understanding of the concept of an economy. What do we need to know about it?
Oh, Dudu, that's a great place to start. An economy is literally the transactions that are happening. Now, we could go all the way back to an agrarian economy, and it would be probably a more barter system and the like, and exchanging goods. And you know, I'd help you plow your land, you help me with the cows type of scenario. But as we look at it today, it's all that financial activity that is happening. So it's happening at individual level, folks buying services and goods from each other, companies as well. And then, of course, at the top of the chain, in a sense, would be your government, who play an outsized role. They're a giant collector of taxes. They then spend those taxes within the economy to, in theory, to improve it and to help it grow. So it's multi-layered, with individuals down at the sort of the bottom rung, and corporates the middle, and then we put governments up at the top.
Sure. Does what a government then influence or have an impact on the individual economically?
It absolutely does. At the simplest level is, what is it taxing, or how much is it taxing, and then what does it do with the proceeds of those taxes? In theory, taxes are taken from the individual for the collective good. But broader than that, it would be policies as well. You know, if in South Africa, for example, we have an unemployment crisis. What is the government doing to address that? If we had much lower unemployment rate, even truthfully a slightly lower unemployment rate, say 25 instead of 30%+, that would have an impact not just on individuals, which would be marked, but on the broader economy as well. So that they really are sort of the big player in the space.
And then you have concepts more so when it comes to perhaps the African continent, where the economies are characterized as emerging markets or developing economies, as opposed to what? And what are the metrics that we use maybe to get to a developed economy?
Yeah, so the classic divide is that emerging economy versus a developed economy. Your developed are sort of across Asia, and I'm thinking here Japan, of course Europe, and then North America, Canada, the US and the like, which much of the rest of the world then sort of qualifies as an emerging economy. You also, as a last point, get your frontier economies, but that really is perhaps a little bit of nuance, and really the world is broadly divided into emerging versus developed. And the idea is, next start with the developed, that they would be much more advanced in terms of infrastructure. They've got the infrastructure. It's in place. They've got roads and hospitals and schools. They're considered to be a lower risk. They'd have a more aging, more stable population, and probably an older population with less young people involved. They're typically much more diversified. They're much more service orientated, where your emerging economy is going to be more industrializing, more buildings. South Africa, we're heavily focused on mining. Weirdly, we also then have a very much service orientated financial services sector. And they're typically considered to be sort of offering better growth prospects in terms of their GDP could grow that much faster due to their smaller size and the growth prospects as opposed to a developing economy. And it's not always as simple as that, but broadly that's what you'd sort of categorize.
Sure. You mentioned the term GDP. What is gross domestic product and how should we understand it more so when we speak of continental economies like the African continent?
So gross domestic product is literally everything that has been consumed, built, and used within a period. Typically, we look at it quarterly or over a year. So in a sense, it's kind of the net worth of the existing of the economy. So you'd have a GDP, and let's say South Africa's was, let's pick a number, a million rand. And that's our GDP. And then what we look at is we then measure it again in 3 months' time. We do it on a quarterly basis. And what growth have we seen over that period? Has it grown 3%, 4%, 1%? The growth usually, excluding inflation, because you don't want the impact of potential high inflation to mask, make it look attractive when it's not. So typically, your GDP is that sort of net worth of the economy. If we look across the African continent, and if we start down here south with ourselves in South Africa, often the largest economy, but growing very, very slowly, struggling to get much above 1% over the last 10, 15 years. There are pockets of the continent which are growing significantly faster. Uganda, Kenya are two examples. There's some which might be growing fast because they've just come out of internal conflict or something, and that could again mask it. But it is, if your economy is growing quickly, and particularly if it's growing faster than the population growth, it means individuals are getting richer. If we go back to South Africa, if we're a million rand economy and there's, let's say, a million people, it's 1 rand a person. And that's a number, doesn't mean much, but what's that relative to everyone else? And that's what we would look at as a GDP per capita. And typically, again, in emerging markets, with GDP per capita markedly lower than the more developed economies.
Okay. I'd like for us to unpack some of the pointers that you have brought up. So when we take a look at a developed economy, you spoke about infrastructure, right? The importance of infrastructure. They've got some of the most advanced infrastructure. How would you characterize infrastructure on the continent? Where are we?
I think some of the first challenges is we look at Africa as a continent, and of course it is.
Sure.
It's also, plus 50 individual True. Economies. And I think often what happens with the infrastructure development within South Africa, is within the African continent rather, is a mismatch. And to use a very cliched example, one country builds a great road up to a border post, and on the other side there's a dirt track. So you've got infrastructure, and then suddenly that lack of it. But infrastructure is hugely important. We talk around an economy wanting to grow, wanting to serve its people. That is primarily going to be from infrastructure. Some of it is your roads, some of it's going to be your hospitals, which is around health and population growth and the like. Some of it's going to be sort of power. And what's important with infrastructure is that you've got to build it in anticipation of need. You can't wait for a population to grow and then say we should put a hospital in now. In an ideal world, you build it and the population, the country kind of grows into that infrastructure. It's hugely important to the development and growth of an economy that there is that base infrastructure of transportation, logistics, health, education, so that an economy has that base on which it can grow, on which it can expand. And without it, it adds significant challenges. We see it in South Africa with some of our mining companies struggling because lack of rail infrastructure or deteriorating rail infrastructure simply means they can't get product to market. So they're hindered in their ability to grow. That both impacts the company directly and potential staff, but also the government in terms of tax collections.
Because there is an opposite of that, Mr. Brown. We, on the podcast, covered that in terms of businesses that are able to operate in spaces of conflict. You take a look at the DRC, for instance, where minerals are able to come out of the country, but there's conflict. And the infrastructure maybe is just a paving of the road from where the mine is leading to the airport to get it out. But when you speak of infrastructure and building it in anticipation of need, You mentioned that with developed economies, usually the population is aging or it's stable. Mm-hmm. On the African continent, we always speak about this youth dividend. By 2050, it is said that 1 in 5 people will be from the African continent. And so how should we understand that? Is there a mismatch?
I think there is. And if we look at, and you mentioned, in a developed economy, the population is typically stable. It's typically going to be older. We've got a growing population in terms of the size of it. And when I say we, the continent as a whole, rather than just necessarily South Africa.
Right.
Our population is growing. And population growth, it matters, or size of population. You know, South Africa, in a perfect world without the nuances of politics and commodities and everything, mm-hmm. you know, Nigeria, population 2.5 times the size of South Africa, should be, in theory, an economy 2.5 times of South Africa, right, if we were on parity. We see the U.S., one of the largest economies in the world, with the largest. That's in part, there's lots of reasons, but part of it is that population size, and that is hugely important. Population gives you an advantage because you've got more people who can transact, more people who can do business, who can be, you know, nurses and police people and teachers and accountants and all of those sort of parts that grow the population. What you also then need is a young population who are coming in to expand that, to bring you more workers, more nurses, teachers, accountants, and everything else. And, you know, on the one side, you've got Japan with a very aging mm-hmm. population. The birth rate is below the death rate, so a declining population. And that's a worry for their government. The benefit that we have in Africa is, as you said, that youth dividend, which really gives us huge potential in, and I say workforce, and workforce not necessarily in manual labor, but right, people who can enter the employment space and grow the economy and do the jobs and utilize that infrastructure we refer to.
And then you mentioned that for a developing economy, industrialization is important. We take a look at what Donald Trump has done. It's only been 6 months, and it feels like it's like 21 months already into this one particular year. His mantra is making America great again, and the bottom line is industrialization. And so when we take a look at the African continent, many of the leaders, or the presidents more so, will talk about beneficiation, and the South African president is no exception. Yeah. What does that mean, and what is hindering beneficiation on the continent?
So the idea on benefit is that we produce a commodity, and let's use gold as a simple example. We produce raw gold, we ship it out, and the rest of the world turns it into jewelry and other useful parts. It's used in electronics, but predominantly in jewelry. Weirdly, Italy sells more gold than we do, yet Italy has zero gold mines. So they buy in the raw gold, and they then turn it into jewelry and then sell that jewelry. The difference is that you can make a lot more profit off an ounce of gold if you're turning it into beautiful jewelry and you add some pretty stones and sell it as wedding bands or whatever the case may be. You lot more profit in that environment than there is in mining the pure raw gold. Now, the mining of the raw gold is using a lot more workers, and that's a benefit to an economy. Absolutely, it is. You know, one person could be sitting in Milan and making, you know, copious amounts of gold ounces into jewelry. In South Africa, we've got, you know, a couple hundred thousand in the gold mining industry. But that ability to do the value add, in a sense, it's the same as with agriculture. You know, it's selling chickens as opposed to selling KFC. You can see, sure, where there's that value add at the point of the KFC. There's been a lot of talk across our continent to do it. And there's I can't think of really strong reasons why it hasn't worked. You know, with respect to someone sitting in Milan and making beautiful jewelry, I've seen exquisite jewelry right here in Johannesburg,
sure,
as beautiful as there is in Milan. So maybe it's around perception. Maybe it's a sense of there's an expectation that if you want beautiful jewelry, you go to Milan, you don't go to Johannesburg or Lagos. But it is a huge opportunity, and it is something which has been spoken about for decades. I think we can go back 20 or more years, and yet so very, very little has happened. And I think because we need to really put some money into it, and we need to sort of empower those skills, and maybe we need to go to the person in Milan and frankly headhunt them and say, you know, come live in Joburg. It's a lovely city. The weather's great. We'll pay you well, and you can do your jewelry manufacturing here, and we can get that benefit from it then.
You mentioned the word value. High value sectors. Would rare earths, because we're hearing a lot of that, more so with everything that is happening around tariffs, with the US president when he was having conversations with the president Ukraine. And he was speaking about, so rare earths are used in EVs, wind turbines, laser technology and medical imaging, military applications as well. So would that be high value sectors? And are we, I'm not sure if the word is leveraging, but are we ready to, never mind ready, are we positioned rather to see the value addition or to realize the value at basic level? And that is now you and I guess, with the spurring on of jobs, with the industrialization so that people are absorbed into the job market.
I think so rare earths in and of themselves, I mean, they're not as rare as the name suggests. Their rarity comes in that they're difficult to extract, and you'd get iron ore, for example. I mean, iron ore is, you know, done by the ton, and rare earths are, you've got tons and tons of dirt, I don't know what the fancy word for it is, right. And from that you extract these multiple different elements. The rare part really is that they're important, they're needed in these new technologies, and that comes to where you want to sit in that value chain. Is there money to be made in extracting rare earths? Absolutely there is. Is there better money to be made in making one of those lithium ion batteries that are a result of rare earths? Absolutely, you're better off in making the battery. But if we go further up the value chain, you're even better off making the mobile phone or electric vehicle that battery goes into. And that's what we see in that distinction between emerging versus developed. In the developed market, they're higher up that value chain. It's more comfortable jobs, you know, someone building an electric vehicle or an iPhone, a much better job than having to go 4 kilometers underground to get the commodities. They're also much more valuable jobs in terms of their profitability. And that's the value add that you refer to. And are we positioned for it? We have the potential for it. But at this point, I don't think we're not even particularly close. Let's look at batteries. There is battery technology happening in South Africa. Mm. They are being manufactured. There are other areas around the continent where it is, but not to the scale and precision that is particularly for an iPhone battery or an electric vehicle.
How important is the financial services sector in any economy?
Hugely important. We are blessed in South Africa with a very, very developed financial services. And it's important for a couple of reasons. I mean, you know, for example, when we do bond issuances, the government issues bonds to raise more debt. Mm-hmm. We've got a very mature, very stable financial sector. So there's a trust around that process. There's buyers for those bonds, and they would be internal. They would be our pension and insurance companies. It's also just small things, like if I need to make a payment to you, the sense that I can do it easily, whether it be electronically via an app or whether it just be, you know, face to face, and I have to hand you the 100 rand I owe you, but I give it to you in the 100 rand note. A financial services sector, and a strong one, is absolutely critical to the whole process, because ultimately all of these interactions are going to be people also being paid and paying, and that needs to be a smooth, seamless, quick, and most important, trusted process, which is so hugely important.
How then do you say to somebody, well, there's many parts of the continent where there's not necessarily financial infrastructure, but you've got fintech, right? So you've got mobile money, mm-hmm. in the form of mobile money. Most of the economies are what? So-called informal, I'll say so-called for now, because we'll unpack that another day. And so how should we understand that?
So I think it's the sort of, I want to call it the informal financial services, but let's look at M-Pesa in East Africa. It's fascinating. And if we take a slightly different, you know, 20 years ago, we were talking about the mobile revolution and what happened in the African continent. The rest of the world did the old-fashioned way, right? They went from telex and letters, and then they went to copper in the ground for telephones, and then they went to mobile. And our continent largely missed skipped the copper in the ground. We had it in South Africa, but East Africa absolutely didn't. The penetration of old school telephones was incredibly low. So there was just a leapfrog to this M-Pesa. And that comes to sort of ingenuity happening, where you can sort of say, well, we don't need to follow that traditional path. We can leap forward and absolutely reap the benefit. And I think you mentioned the informal economy, and I concur with you, put that in inverted commas, perhaps. That is a huge driver across the African continent, where there is a formal economy, and it will be of certain size depending on the country we're talking around. But there's a lot of other activity happening in the informal space, whether it be on a labor side, and that could be someone, a housekeeper or someone maintaining your garden, whether it be someone just, selling vegetables and the like. That is a hugely important, because it creates financial activity and income for a large group of people who otherwise would be traditionally excluded. If we all bought our vegetables at ShopRite, it would be great for ShopRite, but it would cut out a swath of people who are actually making a living. And to be clear, it's a subsistence living, but it's a living off it.
Absolutely. As we wind down the conversation, Mr. Brown, because we're saying that we're looking at the concept of an economy and the role it plays in lifting people or locking them into poverty. One thing we have not touched on in our conversation is leadership, because you can have all of this. And there's pockets where people have done a great job, right? Like M-Pesa. But at the end of the day, you also have government regulation that is going to come in and actually look at what you're doing and how you're playing fairness, etc. And so all of this, locking people out or including them into an economy, can we divorce all of this that we have discussed, or can we divorce leadership from all that we have discussed?
We can't. We absolutely can't. And I mean, I don't know if it's the tragedy of humanity or if it's the blessing of humanity, but leadership plays that critical role. I mean, you mentioned up front Donald Trump. I mean, love him or hate him, he's having an outsized influence globally. And that's because he's the leader of the largest military and economic power in our planet. But leadership is immensely important. They set agendas. They drive the agenda. They make sure it happens. And I think far too often, and I'm not even here just talking necessarily about the African continent, I think we are disserved as a species by our leaders. I think their leadership seems to be more about benefiting them than people. I was raised with the idea that leaders were there to make it better for everyone around them. And we look at leaders and the story come, and I think our leadership is failing us. And a quick example, Uganda, Museveni, saying he's going to be reelected. He's going to have been in office for some 40 years. I remember the reports when he took power in, 1986, and he was railing against the African Union and this old boys club, and and here we are. He found power and he was like, this isn't so bad. I'm a huge fan in term limits and age limits. I think there should be a limit on how many terms you can serve. And frankly, with respect, there's an age at which you should go home and enjoy your retirement. And I know that sounds a little bit ageist, but we need some young people in this leadership as well.
Not at all, because by 6 o'clock you have to take your medication. 6:30 you probably passed out. You're so tired, So no,
exactly.
It's a valid point to make.
And I think what's also important with leadership, and leaders hate this because leaders think that they what matters. But I think what matters as well is that transition to new leaders with new thinking and new ways of doing things. Otherwise, you're stuck. You're stuck with the leader, and you're stuck with their thinking. And their thinking might be fine, but it gets old after a while. And I think our leaders need to learn to, as you say, go and enjoy your retirement.
Yeah, Mr. Brown, thank you very much for your time. Simon Brown is founder of Just One Lap. Before we let you go, what is Just One Lap? What does it represent? Is there a meaning?
Yeah, so we teach people about money. It's an online money sort of university. This was an idea I had 20 plus years ago, that we get just one lap at life and we need to do it right. That is, it's going to be health, it's going to be relationship, it's going to be careers. Part of that, of course, is money, and we focus on the money part. Just one lap at life, let's make sure that we do our money part right.
Just one lap at life. Mr. Brown, always a pleasure. Thank you very much for tuning in to the Business of Africa podcast, where we bring big and small business issues right to your doorstep. You'll hear from us again in the next fortnight, God willing. Bahaichu, Pula.